Former New York Times education correspondent Gene Meroff decided to get his hands dirty when he ran for his local school board in central New Jersey. Meroff shares some hard-earned lessons and wisdom about these Tocquevillian institutions in his new book, School Boards in America, A Flawed Exercise in Democracy. Today we talk with Gene about his experience as a school board member, and now school board president, and whether he sees a future for this last bastion of local control. And we'll explore whether Gene is right when he says that, quote, anyone seeking to improve schools ignores the power of school boards at some peril. Join us for today's edition of the Education Next Book Club. Education Next. We're here today with Gene Meroff. Gene, welcome to the show.
Nice to be with you, Mike.
Yeah, well, Gene, I enjoyed your book very much, School Boards in America, A Flawed Exercise in Democracy. Want to talk about the book, but first, let's talk some about your own personal experience, because what I found so fascinating, of course, is that after following education for, well, close to 40 years, you decided to go ahead and run for school board. Why did you decide to do this?
I was intrigued by the idea of being on the school board. I figured it was a way to perform some public service, which it is for anybody who serves on it. And I think basically it just grew out of the many years that I put into education and seeing school boards operate, but pretty much taking them for granted. And some people approached me and said, why don't you run? And this was a school board that has had its problems, and I thought maybe I could be helpful to the situation.
And this isn't some small, tiny little school district, right? You said this is the fifth largest in New Jersey.
This is the fifth largest in New Jersey, and New Jersey has lots of school boards. There are about 600 in New Jersey, far more than there ought to be. And because there are so many, many of them have fairly small enrollments. Our enrollment is almost 15,000, and at that level, it makes us the fifth largest school district in the state.
Fascinating. So now, of course, you can't just decide to be on the school board and one day you're on the school board. You have to run. And so you tell a little bit about that in the book. I found it interesting. You decided not to seek the teacher union's endorsement.
I thought it was really important, and now as a member of a school board, I think it's really important to be independent. And I think anybody who runs with the endorsement of the teacher union, which once they endorse, helps get that person elected if they can, has a predisposition to look at the teacher union and its desires with a certain amount of subjectivity rather than objectivity. And as a matter of fact, this is pretty timely because I decided to run for a second term, which I haven't said a lot about, but it will be my final term. I think two terms is enough on a school board, 3 years each. And the election will be tomorrow. And I entered this again with two partners, or three seats to be filled, again saying I'm not interested in the teacher union endorsement. And so the teacher union has put up three teacher union activists to run against our slate of three independent people.
Well, we appreciate you doing the interview on the eve of this election. I hope we don't cost you the election.
I hope not. I would have been campaigning today, but I'm going to take a train that will get me back home by midnight, and I'll be on the train platforms tomorrow trying to reach commuters so that they will vote the ticket when they return from work.
Okay, so you have sort of a reform slate when you first ran and now again. I mean, so I'm curious, though. I mean, in a lot of places, if you don't get the union endorsement, then you're done. I mean, how'd you end up winning?
Well, for one thing, I think that they took their power for granted and didn't realize when three of us ran together 3 years ago that we'd be a threat to them. So the element of surprise was pretty important to it. I think that we were able to sell ourselves as valid candidates who would be good for the school district. I think the idea of independence appealed to many people, but it continues to be a battle because the teacher union in this particular school district has dominated for many years and been able to pretty much handpick who goes onto the board through its endorsement. And the next year, endorsed one candidate. He lost the seat by 32 votes, which was pretty close. Mm-hmm. Last year, we endorsed three independent candidates against three incumbents who we felt were enabling the leadership, and our three candidates just swept away and they won. And so now we've been in the majority for a year, and the reason I'm running is so that we could hold that majority mm-hmm. and continue to make what I believe are improvements in the school district.
Yeah, but I imagine the teacher union is probably gunning for your job.
Yes, they are. They're out to oust me, and one of the people running with me is a retired school superintendent, and he has a doctorate from Columbia, and they tried to discredit both of us.
Mm. Interesting. All right. So you must have had some assumptions going into your service on the school board. Again, you've followed this issue for a long time. I'm curious. I mean, what did you expect to find? And have there been any particular surprises?
I guess I wasn't fully aware of the extent to which the responsibilities of the school board revolve around governance. And I think a lot of people, even if they know a lot about schools, don't quite appreciate that the main role of a school board is governance. And this means, of course, that school boards are not supposed to administer. Mm-hmm. The administering goes on from the superintendent. Nobody who works in a school district works for the school board except for the superintendent. And so anything that we achieve has to be through the superintendent. And the extent to which that is what the governance is all about was probably something that I didn't fully appreciate before I was on a board.
Mm-hmm. Some of the stories in there were really interesting. If you wouldn't mind, tell us about the Rosh Hashanah controversy.
Oh, well, in New Jersey, the state determines when special elections can be held. And this is for referenda for a construction project. And there were two dates remaining in the calendar year, one of which was more distant, and it would have meant that if we got the item passed, we wouldn't have been able to finish the construction by summer. So we went for the one that was in September, and anybody who didn't want to go to the polls could, of course, vote by absentee ballot. So we didn't think that would be a problem, even though...
And what day was it on?
It was on Rosh Hashanah,
yeah.
Which lasts 2 days for people who are most Jews who are most observant. And I don't remember if it was the first or the second day, but in any event, it was on one of those 2 days. It turned out to cause a great, great controversy in the community among people who felt we were violating their religious beliefs. And we went through with it, but it was very controversial. And as a result, the state legislature passed an act saying that these construction dates the votes could no longer be scheduled on any religious holiday. I don't know if they knew what they were getting into, because New Jersey, as many states, is pretty diverse, and there are a lot of religious holidays if one observes the calendars of all of the religions.
Right. Just an interesting indication of the kinds of controversies you can get dragged into. Maybe not what you were expecting to be involved in when you entered.
Absolutely.
All right, so let's talk about the book some. Again, School Boards in America. Why did you decide to write this book? And tell me about the audience. Who is this book for?
This is my 13th book about education. Most of my books have been aimed at what's called a crossover audience. I try to write both for people who are in the education field and for serious readers who are not in the education field. So my audience for this book and for a number of my previous books is pretty wide. Anybody who's interested in public affairs, as well as anybody who's on the policy level in education. And I decided to write it because it seemed interesting. My books have been about many, many subjects. I've come at education from a number of vantages. And this just seemed to me a good subject. I started thinking about the book probably about the time that I thought it might be interesting to run for the school board. I wasn't on the school board at the time. And I began my research and doing some of my writing along the way as I did my research, and then I continued. It spanned a period of about 2.5 years, actually, while it was in gestation.
Mm. You know, at some points it's felt a little bit like a primer for somebody running for school board or new on a school board. Was it intended like that?
Not exactly, but I think it performs that task. What I did discover in my literature search, and I did a fairly extensive literature search in connection with the book, is that almost everything before this book that's been written about school boards has been aimed at sitting school board members or aspiring school board members. And that's just fine, but there's a certain how-to character to those kinds of books. I wrote a book that I thought could interest far more people than those who are on or wish to be on school boards. And I wanted to seek a wide audience for the book. I think that I've been able to fulfill that, but I do think, on the other hand, that the book would be worth reading for anybody who sits on a school board or wants to sit on a school board.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Jean Maroff, the author of School Boards in America.
For in-depth features, cutting-edge research, and up-to-the-minute commentary on education policy, check out educationnext.org. There you'll find blog entries, new articles published weekly, plus videos, podcasts, and more. That's educationnext.org.
And we're back with Jean Maroff, author of School Boards in America, A Flawed Exercise in Democracy. All right, Jean, you jump into all the different roles that school boards play, the important elements that they oversee. One of the first things you talk about is curriculum and, of course, textbook adoption. You talk about a math war that happened in, a nearby school district in New Jersey. What happened?
Ridgewood, New Jersey is a fairly affluent town with people who are pretty well educated. What gradually happened in some of the elementary schools was the teachers decided that they wanted to take a more hands-on approach to mathematics instruction, which sort of moved away from fundamentals in some people's opinion. And gradually, as parents became aware of what was happening in the math instruction in the schools, a note of alarm went up in the community, because some people felt that the children were just not getting what they should be getting in mathematics instruction in the elementary schools.
Was this everyday math? Was this program?
It may have been everyday math. I'm not sure exactly what program it might have been, but I think it may have been, but my memory doesn't serve me well enough to say exactly that it was. But it definitely was something that shied away from what some people would consider the fundamentals. And it even reached the point where the teachers would send home homework that was kind of traditional, because they thought that would satisfy the parents, but it wasn't the same thing they were teaching in school. And as more and more people found out about this, there were blogs, there were emails flying back and forth, and ultimately, there was a search for a new superintendent, and some of the opponents of the math that was being taught in the elementary schools did some research on this person, who was coming from New York State, from Long Island, and they discovered that he, in their opinion, was probably a proponent of the kind of math instruction that was taking place, to which they objected. They were able, successfully, after he had been appointed, and he was to come for kind of a meet-and-greet session, to get him to withdraw. Wow. It got so controversial. Ultimately, a new superintendent came in. There was a committee appointed, and they went through a selection process, and it had really quieted down by then. Whether it will flare up again, it's hard to say, but it's the kind of controversy one sees erupt over textbooks and materials.
Yeah, and it's nothing new. I mean, you also tell this very important story, and people need to know this from sort of the history, recent history of American education, from 1974, the district in West Virginia.
Yeah, in Kanawha County.
Yeah.
Where there was objections on grounds of patriotism, whether or not something was anti-religious. These were books that were to be read as part of the literature in the schools, and they were available for instruction before for inspection, excuse me, before the school district adopted them. Apparently, not too many people inspected them, but once the school board adopted it, it caused a great stir in this area, which is a mining part of West Virginia, and ended up with people being arrested. It ended up with a strike by the miners over this issue, and the whole school board changing.
Right. And I understand that was sparked the religious right in many ways. That's something
that
traces back to that.
It certainly did.
And we see these battles over evolution. And so what's your take? When you see these kinds of controversies, I mean, what advice do you have for school board members? What's the role of the school board in trying to make these kinds of decisions?
People have to understand, and I tried to make it clear in the book, that for the most part, school boards are no more than rubber stamps when it comes to textbooks, materials, and curricula. And seldom do the kinds of situations arise that we've just been talking about. But so school board members should really be wary and more careful about this. And they should really work closely with the superintendent and the staff members who work with the superintendent if they suspect at all that something is going to be controversial, because they're there to respond to the interests and needs of the community.
You know, one argument against school boards or making these decisions centrally is to say, hey, you know, why don't we let schools within a district be different from one another and use different curriculum and let parents choose among them? And if somebody wants the reform math, they can go to that school, and they want a more traditional math, they can go to the other school. That the problem here is we're trying to make one size fits all decisions. What would you say to that?
I think in a school district, it might create some problems when students are studying vastly different material at different levels, and there's not a certain commonality to their education. Certainly, I see room for something that would be along the lines of a magnet school, which does allow for differences. But I think that it is more than most school districts could handle if you have vast differences among the schools. So much so, for example, that a child moving from one part of the community to another and far away from the school that he or she has been attending might find that what's being studied in that school and the level at which it's being studied varies so greatly from another school in the same district.
Yeah. Let's talk about budgeting. You say this is one of the most important roles that school boards play, and this is probably the thing that gets the most attention every year is when the budget is set. Yet you have a lot of concern about whether or not school board members have the business acumen and the data and all the information they need to make these decisions.
Yes, I do have concern about that. And also, I think the public has to understand that when the budget is put forward, there are certain limitations on what the school board can do when it's in the midst of, say, a teacher contract, which accounts for the largest amount of spending in the budget. And some people say, well, we could save a lot of money. But if there are contractual obligations and the school district is in the middle of that budget period, most of the cuts, if they're going to be cuts, will come out of areas that most directly affect the students, such as transportation, sports, after-school activities. These are the areas in which school boards can most easily cut because they have the most flexibility there. Those are not affected by the contract, most likely. But that shows how important it is for there to be careful bargaining when collective bargaining takes place with the various groups that work in the school district. Because if those needs aren't addressed at that time, well, then it's written stone for a period of time, usually about 3 years or so. And going back to the way you posed the question, Mike, I think the most school board members are pretty dependent on the view, especially of the business administrator and the superintendent, when it comes to the budget. And people probably don't appreciate the great role that a business administrator plays in a school district.
Mm-hmm. You know, we have been writing a lot about how to stretch the school dollar in these difficult times. And of course, schools nationwide are facing this funding cliff, some very dire circumstances. And yet, as you say, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of flexibility there. Can a school district like yours say to the teachers union, hey, we didn't expect the bottom to fall out here on our finances like it has. We need to reopen the contract. Does that happen?
We said it last year because of the financial circumstances, and we were in the midst of contractual agreements. And all of the smaller unions allowed us to delay their scheduled raises, the custodians, the supervisors and administrators, and one of the other smaller unions. The teacher union would not. They would not go along with it. And so we had to honor the contract. We would have no choice about that. But school boards do say that. However, they are dependent on whether or not the bargaining unit is willing to do that. Mm-hmm. I suspect in some locales, bargaining units will more readily do that than in others.
And so what that means is what? They would get their raises and then you'd be forced to cut staff?
Yes, exactly. I don't think people realize on the outside that in order to meet the contractual situation, often it means having to lay off other people, yeah. Especially the younger ones, the untenured ones, and then it might start going into those who have had tenure the shortest time. And understand that if a teacher is making $90,000 or more, as 51% of the teachers are in our district, that keeping one of those teachers, and I'm not advocating that you shouldn't, but that keeping one of them means you get rid of two that are at the starting level. So, and then you have a game of musical chairs where people move down by seniority to fill positions that have been vacated. And you may have somebody, for example, teaching kindergarten who previously was teaching fifth or sixth grade and isn't as familiar with some of the dynamics of early education.
Wow. Yes. You talk about the interest in trying to move some of these budget decisions down to the school level, to say that individual schools should have more discretion over how their budget is spent. Again, I mean, isn't this another case for saying, hey, we want less authority at the school board level?
Well, I think if you have good principals and they surround themselves with a cadre of good teachers, they should have something to say about it. I don't know that they should have the final say, but they should have something to say about how their money's going to be spent and what their needs are. Now, there are limitations to that. If they decide they're going to get rid of all the second grades in the school, obviously that's not a great decision. But there are ways of doing it and still honoring the kinds of objectives that the school board has.
Patronage. Of course, talking about New Jersey here, but you write about patronage nationwide. Is this still happening? Are we still seeing school board members getting their friends and relatives hired as teachers?
Yes, we are. And I was quoted on the front page of the Star Ledger, the largest newspaper in New Jersey, deploring that situation, and my critics didn't like me bringing that up. But I also said at the time when I was interviewed by the reporter that there's an even bigger problem that school districts face around the country, and I wrote about it in the same chapter that you've been mentioning, Mike. I called the chapter, I titled it Jobs, 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 and a bigger problem in patronage is the problem of cronyism. People getting jobs and promotions depending on their connections. And when we ran and when we can and running again this year, our position is it should all depend on what you know, not who you know.
Right. And that's for jobs, but also for contracts, right?
And what
well, I mean that there's, you write about in the book that there's plenty of businesses out there that do business with school districts, individuals that might provide yep. special ed services, sometimes food service, sometimes transportation, and that there's a lot of risk that these contracts can be let in a way that is all about cronyism and not about quality.
Absolutely. That those connections sometimes do lead to those contracts, and people have to remember that school districts and school boards are major consumers of goods and services. When we buy a boiler, for example, we have 17 schools in our district and the boilers don't last forever. We're talking about a big purchase item. When we enter into a food contract, Again, it's a big purchase item, but it goes all the way down to the level when you make arrangements with psychologists who are okayed to work for the school district on a fee-for-service basis. They're not direct employees, but they should be retained just on what they know, not who they know.
Right. Okay. I talk a lot about in the book hiring superintendents. Of course, as you said before, this is the only person that works for the school board. Critically important decision. What have you learned from your experience and from your research in the book about hiring the right superintendent?
I learned that it's a very difficult process. It was made even more difficult in New Jersey recently by a directive from the governor who said nobody working in a district with an enrollment over 10,000 should be paid more than $175,000. And the result of that has been really disastrous in New Jersey because a lot of the superintendents in New Jersey, and I indicated before the enrollment's not terrifically large in most districts, have been making over $175,000. And that would mean that the next time this person's contract comes around for renewal, the board may not pay that person more than $175,000. And what we're seeing is some really good people leaving the state. And why shouldn't they? Because they could make more money just crossing the lines into Pennsylvania, New York State, Connecticut, and that's what they're doing. And I think it's going to cause a leadership vacuum in the upper ranks of the administrations in the school districts. I think the governor, he's said a lot to bring problems to the fore in education in New Jersey, picked the wrong target with this. It was an easy target to pick, but there are much better ones that would have a lot more financial impact, such as asking teachers to pay more than the 1.5% of their salary toward the health benefits for them and their family. That would have resounded with much more impact than just going after the superintendents.
Right, though he did go after that as well, right? Unsuccessfully.
He hasn't been successful so far on that. This one he could... Well, I'm going to say he could unilaterally deal with, but it's not clear even now that he had the law on his side. Yeah. And so we'll have to see what happens with it.
All right. Well, we're going to talk about some more of those same issues, including your take on the teacher unions, teacher tenure, and those important issues that school boards must struggle with. Again, we're here with Gene Maroff, author of School Boards in America. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Education Next Book Club.
For in-depth features, cutting-edge research, and up-to-the-minute commentary on education policy, check out educationnext.org. There you'll find blog entries, new articles published weekly, plus videos, podcasts, and more. That's educationnext.org.
Here with Gene Maroff, author of School Boards in America. Okay, Gene, we talked about teacher unions at the top of the show in respect to your own election, but let's talk about them writ large here. First of all, teacher tenure. You write about this, and I am guessing that you're not a huge fan of teacher tenure.
I think there should be some large-scale changes if teacher tenure is to remain. Right now in New Jersey, and probably in most states, a teacher automatically receives tenure, which is tantamount to lifetime guarantee of a job, after 3 years. And I think that's much too short. If there's going to be tenure, it should take longer to get it. We see in higher education, for example, it takes at least 6 or 7 years to get tenure. And tenure is not what it used to be in higher education because many institutions have gone to renewable contracts rather than tenure. But I think the way to start, if you're going to deal with tenure, it's not going to be eliminated. I really doubt that. But I think it can be reformed. And I think there would be a constituency for reforming it. Number one, making it take longer to get tenure. Number two, having more safeguards along the way to make sure that the right people are remaining in the school system as future tenured people along the way, year by year, because they're supposed to be very well evaluated each step of the way. And I think both of those steps would create a better situation. It would be improved.
Now, the unions will say, look, you have the authority as a school board right now to not renew teachers who haven't gotten tenure yet. And yet, in most places, those junior teachers, they get tenure almost automatically.
Certainly, they get tenure almost automatically if they made it into and through the third year. Probably the greatest fallout takes place right after the first year. There are people, I think, if you were to do a survey, I haven't actually seen statistics, but I know in our own district, there are people who are told after the first year, this is not a suitable occupation for you. A smaller number get that message after the second year. But as I say, if they get into the third year, they're fairly sure of doing it, of receiving tenure. So I think there really has to be a better system that develops people along the way to make sure that they are the people we want in the schools in the long term.
Now, you call teacher unions a juggernaut. What's been your experience with the unions?
Well, teacher unions can be very popular, very powerful. And now we're talking about each locale, because each locale is a teacher union local, all of which then are affiliated with a state organization. It so happens in New Jersey that the state organization, the umbrella group over all of the local teacher unions, is called the New Jersey Education Association. It is very powerful. The legislators are quite responsive to it because it can wield a good deal of votes. And they also are a powerful lobbying force. They are the largest spender of lobbying money in the state of New Jersey, almost $7 million a year. And that's what unions are supposed to do. They're supposed to look out for the interests of their members. And they do that very well. And you see that at the national level as well. The largest single group represented at the Democratic National Convention every 4 years is made up of people who are members of either the American Federation of Teachers or the National Education Association.
So here you are in your school district or any other around the country. You've got professional negotiators on the union side, backed with a lot of resources, and amateur school board members. When they go into negotiations. Tell us about that.
That puts the school boards at a disadvantage, but school boards are allowed to hire people to negotiate for them. Many of them tend not to, but we're just going into a bargaining for a contract that will expire on June 30th, and we retain somebody with lots of experience at negotiating on a hourly basis to do that work for us. And so we are going in with the idea that we want a contract that not only is fair to staff, but fair to students and taxpayers as well.
Now, but this is fairly unusual, right? I mean, you seem to indicate in the book that for the most part, school boards don't have a very stiff spine, that they give in, that they give a lot of concessions to the unions, that it's an unfair negotiating balance. Is that fair to say?
I think it tends to be that way. I think some school boards are more committed and determined than others when it comes to contract negotiation. You have to remember that until 2008, through the 90s and in the early 2000s, we were in a period of great economic growth in this country, with the exception, of course, the dot-com bust around 2000, 2001. But for the most part, the school boards were able to accede to these demands and just keep the trajectory on a upward slope. And now we're at a place, at least as I look at our school district, where 80%, and it's probably not atypical, 80% of our expenditures are for compensation and benefits. That leaves only one out of every $5 going to the more direct student needs that I mentioned earlier in our conversation. So the trajectory cannot be maintained as it is. Also, we have to be responsive to the homeowners, property owners, who just don't want to pay the kinds of property tax increases they've seen before. We've put forth a budget this year that might fail. We haven't been able to pass a budget in 5 years. And if this budget fails, the interesting thing is that most of the increase that's in the budget is going to occur nonetheless because of declining property values in our community. Business and industry, we've had a lot of industry in this community, in Edison, New Jersey. Business and industry are dying or moving out. And so the property base shrinks as a result. Plus, people and commercial properties are being reassessed downward at the request of the owners. It means that This year, even if we have a failed budget, we will have to have a higher tax rate, and we don't set the tax rate. We only say how much money we need, but we would have to have a higher tax rate to produce the same amount of money that was produced last year. And I think a lot of school districts are up against that.
Wow, it's a real squeeze.
Yes, it is.
And so in that environment, you need to have the teachers and the other employees being willing to take some concessions.
Well, people have to understand that it can't be the way it was in the old days. And our school board, after having to lay off dozens upon dozens of people last year, I shouldn't even say lay off, to fire them, to dismiss them from the jobs, we even reached the point that we had no untenured teachers left in the elementary schools. That's how bad it got. We have hired a few since then. But we can't stay on the same route that we were on before. It has to change. So our school board has committed itself that we don't want to have any more people losing their jobs. We want people who are employed there now to continue to keep their jobs. We even scheduled a budget that would add 27 new teachers, mostly at the primary level, to really work on the foundation for kids. But on the other hand, to be able to do that, we have to get a workable contract.
Interesting. And you're saying you haven't been able to pass a budget now for 5 years in
a row? That's right. And tomorrow we'll find out whether or not that's going to go into a sixth year. I think people have to remember, whether it's our community or any other, that typically now only one out of five households has a child in the public schools. So that creates a base in which most people don't feel the same kind of connection. Their children have grown up. They have no children in that household, or they use non-public schools.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of challenges facing school boards. Many people have called for other forms of governance arrangements, charter schools, mayoral control, even state takeovers in some cases. What's your take on these different alternatives? Do you see promise in them?
I see the most promise in those alternatives in the districts that have failed their students or are failing their students. We have, unfortunately, several such intensely urban settings in New Jersey, for example, in Newark and Camden and Patterson, that have not been successful with lots of students. Maybe the time comes that charter schools might be more successful. I don't know if they would be. There's a kind of a mixed bag on that. Or even vouchers to let students get totally out of the public school system. I think that's a possibility. I don't know that that's an answer for school districts like ours that are succeeding. We are not a failed school district. And if students are to go to a charter school, for example, from who are residents of our district, we would have to pay $9,900 per student. And that's tough. That's really tough. Our district is such. New Jersey has really been squeezing school districts, other than the ones, the urban type that I just mentioned. In our school district, 93% of the revenues come from local taxpayers. 93%. I don't think you'd find that typical across the country, but you'd find a lot of those in New Jersey. And you'd find some in New Jersey now that get virtually nothing from the state.
Wow. Now, you will hear from some people saying, look, the reason we need mayoral control or charter schools is because it's harder for the teacher unions to capture those entities. That if you have a popular, strong mayor, they can be tougher on the unions than a school board, where, you know, you might lose election tomorrow because the teacher unions want you out. It's more fragile. I mean, what do you say to those critics of school boards? Say that, just say, look, they're, in most cases, they're going to get captured by the established interests. You might have a reformer for a few years, but eventually they'll get kicked out.
Well, if you have independent school board members, like I and the present majority on our school board are, I don't care if I lose an election, only that it puts the school board back in the position maybe of not being independent. But personally, I have nothing to lose. I don't get paid anything for all the time I put into it. And so I'm willing to be independent. I'm not on there to be reelected. A mayor is a professional politician generally. He is there to be reelected. I would say that the mayor has just as much reason to want to be responsive to unions as the average school board member does.
How can we get more people to run as independent members around the country?
I think it's getting very difficult. You know, there was a time when being on your local school board was a matter of noblesse oblige, and it was possible to get the paragons of the community to do school board service. I think that school board service has become onerous in many ways. I think school boards have tasks that could be better handled by other entities that would do it on a regional basis. I think that school board members sometimes get abused by the public. And so it's becoming increasingly more difficult to get on school boards the kind of people who could make the best contribution.
Some would say that, you know what, it's not that we should just get rid of school boards. Let's just get rid of local control entirely. You've got countries like Australia and Canada, federalist countries, where they run their school systems from the state. There might be regional offices that is a part of a chain of command, but you wouldn't have any local governing authority at all. You know, what's wrong with that, particularly in smaller states?
I don't know that it's necessarily wrong, and it does exist in that form in other places in the world. I think that we have a system that's been in place for hundreds of years, and I don't think it's going to change. It could only be changed state by state. There'd be no other way legally of changing it. I don't think it will change. I don't think legislatures want to change it. And so I think the best thing to do is to live with the system we have, recognize it's there to stay, and try to make it as good as it might be.
And the last question is, you call school boards in America a flawed exercise in democracy. So not fatally flawed, but just flawed.
Not fatally flawed, I hope, at this point. It could turn out after a period of time that they are fatally flawed, but I'm not willing to concede that at this time.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much, Gene, for coming on the show for us today. Again, Gene Maroff, the author of School Boards in America, A Flawed Exercise in Democracy. Folks can find your book online and, of course, enjoy this and other Education Next Book Club podcasts at educationnext.org. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you, Michael.
Executive producer of the Education Next Book Club is Marcy Kansterum. Audio engineer is Joe Portnoy. And I'm your host, Mike Petrilli, for the Education Next Book Club.